A lot of video gamers had to drag themselves back into the real world today after a big weekend in front of their screens. Sales broke records last week as two new games hit the stores. The new version of Call of Duty sold 6 million copies. That's a game that falls in the category known as first-person shooters. And fantasy role-playing fans bought 3 million copies of the new version of Elder Scrolls. It's called Skyrim. Beth Accomando of member station KPBS reports.
My 18-year-old son, Tony Weidinger, spent the last 3 days fighting infinite dragons. And this morning, he sounded wiped out.
Picked up Elder Scrolls Skyrim on Friday at about 1 in the morning. And I've been playing all weekend. It's now 5:30 Monday morning, and I've played about 20 hours.
Skyrim is the fifth installment in the fantasy role-playing game, The Elder Scrolls. Players fight all sorts of magical and monstrous enemies, including plenty of dragons. The prospect of such an adventure had my son all revved up last Thursday night as he went to wait in line for the game.
We got there at 10, so we figured that we would at least get a good position in line. We did. We're like fifth, sixth. Come home, set up two TVs, two systems with two different games, and play them until our bodies give out or we have to leave.
That was a typical plan of attack for most of the people waiting in line at the GameStop in the San Diego suburbs. Like my son and his friend, David Petruzza was planning to dedicate his weekend to Skyrim.
Oh, for a game like this, you should more or less just say goodbye to your life now. You know, wife, kids, job, bills, bye.
I'm going to play like 24 hours and then drink a Mountain Dew to keep me up and then play another 24 hours.
Kira Morales was one of the few female gamers in line. But everyone was excited about the rare opportunity of picking up a new release on a Friday before a three-day weekend with nothing to distract them from going home and immediately playing their new game. Modern Warfare 3, on the other hand, came out at 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, says 17-year-old Cameron Martin. And a lot of gamers had to choose between sleeping, school, and blowing people away online.
I hear a lot of students came down with Modern Warfare-itis Tuesday.
The attendance office at Cameron's school couldn't verify a spike in absenteeism, but they laughed and said they would start paying more attention to the gaming release schedule. Teachers reported a lot of bleary-eyed students who could barely drag themselves to class on Tuesday after late-night sessions of Modern Warfare 3.
Watch and learn.
So if your kid or coworker was a little slow today or couldn't quite focus, Skyrim or Modern Warfare 3 might be the culprit. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Guy Raz. Foreclosures, millions of them, have been a central feature of the economic downturn. Preventing more of them is widely believed to be crucial to economic recovery. For some homeowners facing foreclosure, the Obama administration has been pushing banks to make loans more affordable. But the effort has been marred by mistakes.
Now the federal government is launching a nationwide review of foreclosures over the past couple of years. The review will be seeking homeowners who were treated unfairly by banks. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, unfair treatment can cause a lot of damage.
Banks have just started mailing out letters to upwards of 4 million homeowners. Federal regulators have ordered them to do that to try to find people who have suffered financial harm due to the bank's mistakes and to offer, quote, remediation. Plenty of homeowners feel that they've been harmed, many because they didn't get what's called a loan modification.
It is really quite shocking.
Gary Klein is an attorney who represents homeowners. He says that many should have qualified for lower interest rates through President Obama's foreclosure prevention program.
There are tens of thousands of people across the country who, because the banks were doing such a bad job of implementing the program, didn't get a modification and who are therefore out of their homes.
Klein shifts over to his computer and pulls up a letter that Bank of America recently sent to one homeowner.
So what are we looking at here?
We heard from a woman in Wisconsin named Christina King, who had applied for the Home Affordable Modification Program, HAMP, and was denied.
It turns out that Christina King was the perfect candidate for this Obama loan mod program and should have been approved. The Kings had saved up a $20,000 down payment when they bought the house, but they ended up stuck in an expensive 10% interest rate home loan from Countrywide.
And this is not a big, huge house. This is a $130,000 house, a very small, modest home. So for us, this was not anything We bought too big for our britches. It was that my husband, working in architecture, a lot of engineering got shut down.
King says her husband had his hours cut way back at work, and when they tried to get a loan modification, she says Bank of America repeatedly lost documents, claimed that she didn't make a payment when she actually did make the payment, and then she was told that she was being evicted. Whether the bank took ownership of the house is actually unclear, but the bank put a big foreclosure sign on the front door and changed the locks.
We tried to prove it. We tried to talk to them. They said there's nothing we could do. That we missed a payment. We show them that I had photocopies of the cleared checks. Nope, they refused, you know, and we have eight children.
Today, King and her husband and their eight children are living in a local church rectory. The church is letting them stay there while they look for another place to rent. But in September, Bank of America sent the Kings a pretty surprising letter. More than a year after they had left their house, they get this letter. Lawyer Gary Klein reads from it.
We told you that your loan was not eligible for this program because you missed a trial period plan payment. However, this was incorrect. We apologize for any inconvenience this may have caused you. So what they're doing is they're acknowledging they made a very big mistake.
And the letter goes on to offer the Kings a loan modification. But the problem now is the Kings' house has stood vacant for a year through a Wisconsin winter, and it's a wreck.
There's over 6 feet of water in the basement. The furnace is destroyed. The sewer system backed up because there's sewage in the upstairs bathroom and in the first floor. It's infested with mice.
After NPR contacted Bank of America about this, the bank pledged to help the Kings. We talked to Dan Fromm, who's a senior vice president at the bank, and asked him,
what happens next?
We are committed to working with them to ensure that that their home is returned to the quality that they left it in. We'll absolutely invest to make the repairs necessary in the home. And in terms of what happens while those repairs are underway, we'll work with the King family to determine what's in their best interest, but certainly we'll support them on their need for some temporary housing.
So it sounds like the Kings will get their house back. But their case was not part of this new review process that's just getting underway, and there's bound to be tens or even hundreds of thousands of people who feel they've been harmed by similar mistakes. Sorting through all that will be a giant undertaking. And some housing experts are skeptical that that many people will get a response like the Kings did. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This fall, New Yorkers have been trying out demo versions of a new bike. In time, it could become as common as the city's yellow cabs. New York has chosen an Oregon company to set up a fleet of 10,000 rental bikes. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, April Baer explains how Alta Bike Share went from tiny startup to major player.
Alta founder Mia Burke likes to show off what's behind her office. It's Portland's only solar-powered bike share station.
It's a modular station, so any user would come up to the station, a member would have a fob. Looks like this.
Burke demonstrates how clients will charge up electronic fobs with credit and release a sturdy street bike for a short-term rental.
You'd put your fob in here and a green light would come on, and when the green light comes on, boom, you just pull the bike out.
Burke used to work for the city of Portland. Then she started doing consulting work. When she went into business, she felt pretty isolated. So few people were trained to design the needed infrastructure.
We had this like self-fulfilling cycle going on that these students come out of college in landscape architecture, architecture, engineering, and planning, grounded in a thinking around everybody's going to drive everywhere.
So she started teaching a class at Portland State University.
We had to break that by changing the academic offerings.
Before long, Burke had a pool of smart, talented people ready to work on bike projects. She created her own labor pool. The contract with New York is a watershed moment for Alta Bike Share. It won't be funded with taxpayer money. John Orcutt is with New York's Department of Transportation. He says the city kept a close eye on how other revenue models have panned out, particularly a big one in the UK, sponsored by Barclays Bank.
You know, we clearly took note of London's ability to land a major corporate sponsor. And, you know, obviously we in London are peers in terms of big market, you know, cities with huge numbers of eyeballs on the street.
Alta has to find a corporate sponsor to bankroll $50 million in startup costs in exchange for naming rights or ads on the bikes. Once the funding is secured, Alta expects to hire more than 200 people in New York to set up and maintain the system. The bikes themselves will come from a Canadian company that makes heavy-duty, theft-resistant bikes called Bixies for fleet use. Jeffrey Miller heads the Alliance for Biking and Walking. He says Mia Burke positioned Alta to be in the right place at the right time as bike shares took off.
She's the Steve Jobs of bicycling.
Alta set up successful bike shares using the Bixie system in Boston and Washington, D.C., which is the largest operating bike share in the country. Miller credits the company's rise to Burke's knowledge of how city bureaucracies and rental systems work.
I think it's remarkably rapid in that 2 years they've gone from starting a new business. You know, it's essentially going to be a $50 million contract.
The flexibility of the system is a plus. Riders want the bike when they want it, where they want it, not in the garage. Stations can be picked up and moved if they're not getting enough use. Mia Burke's influence is seen all over Portland's bike scene. Not only did she help design the city's key bikeways and mentor cohorts of bike engineers, she does her part to create the next generation of cyclists, too. This is a fundraising bike derby at her daughter's elementary school. The kids got sponsors, and now they're zipping around a traffic circle doing laps to raise money.
We got about 40% of our kids biking and walking now.
After big bike share successes back east, it's now coming home to Portland. The city is pursuing federal funding for its own bike share program, and Alta will likely bid on the project. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Portland, Oregon.
This is NPR News. Now to the wild frontier of e-books. Today, Amazon began shipping the latest iteration of its e-reader called the Kindle Fire. And the company is not only selling books for these devices, Amazon has also introduced a lending library. But as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, some publishers and authors were taken aback to find that their books were part of the lending program.
If you go to the main webpage of Amazon's lending library, you'll see a display of covers that includes some very popular books: The Hunger Games trilogy, Moneyball, A Reliable Wife.
Well, I was rather startled to be included.
Robert Gulrick is the author of A Reliable Wife. He never gave permission for his book to be included in the lending library, but then again, he didn't necessarily have to.
You know, if any bookstore bought 20 copies of my book, they would be entitled to give it away to whoever they wanted. So in a retail environment, it's very hard to tell them what to do with my book.
But Amazon can't include just any book in its lending library. The six major publishing houses have negotiated a way of selling their e-books to Amazon that precludes using them in a lending library without permission. Smaller houses who sell their e-books wholesale to the retailer don't have that protection. Rachel Deal of Publishers Weekly says Amazon approached publishing houses last summer with different deals. Most said no, but that didn't stop Amazon from including some of those publishers' titles without telling them.
That's got to be frustrating, and it's got to be, on some level, embarrassing to have to go to your authors and say, "We didn't know this was happening. We're sorry."
It's a tricky situation for publishers, says Deal, because Amazon sells so many books, and that makes it hard for anyone to speak up on the subject.
It gives you a sense of just how scared publishers are of Amazon, because nobody will come out and say, "This is a problem and we're angry about it."
Literary agents are speaking out. Brian DeFiore of the Association of Authors Representatives says his organization wants to know how authors will be compensated if Amazon begins making deals with the larger publishing houses. They're also concerned that Amazon is simply using books to sell Kindles.
Giving away someone's creative work as an incentive to buy some other service or product, it feels, whether it's legal or not, it certainly feels problematic.
Writer Robert Gulrich has another worry: the effect Amazon's lending library may have on independent bookstores. No one, says Gulrich, can compete with free.
Reliable Wife would never, ever have become a bestseller without the support and hand-selling of independent booksellers. And I think anything that weakens independent booksellers weakens the entire literary discourse in the country, and I'm all for a healthy and vibrant literary discourse.
And here's another sign of Amazon's pervasive influence in the book industry. Gulrich himself is a member of Amazon Prime, and that, of course, makes him eligible to use the lending library. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Guy Raz. Open up Don DeLillo's new book, The Angel Esmeralda. And on the inside cover, you'll find a list of novels, also by Don DeLillo, it reads. And there you'll find the titles of 15 celebrated works of American fiction: Falling Man, White Noise, Underworld. 15 huge novels spanning a lifetime of writing. But DeLillo's latest book, for the first time, is not a novel. The Angel Esmeralda is a collection of 9 short stories, 9 brief flashes, which, like DeLillo's longer work, center on characters who feel out of sync with the worlds around them. The stories are arranged chronologically. The earliest was written in 1979, the latest finished just this year. They trace the arc of American life over the past 30 years, and also, as Don DeLillo told me, the arc of his career.
When I started thinking about myself as a writer, the work I did was almost exclusively devoted to the short story. I think many writers in those years started with the story. The American short story is such a classic form. And I wrote a number of stories and managed to get a couple published in literary magazines. And at a certain point, I decided to take a leap, the existential leap, into the novel. And that took me a long time to write my first novel. When I finished, I stayed with the novel for a time, through the 1970s. At the end of the 70s, I wrote the first short story I'd done in quite a long time, and that turns out to be the first story in this book called Creation. And then occasional stories subsequently.
There are many characters in this book who are alone, or at least isolated, and you mentioned Creation. In that story, you have a couple struggling to get a plane ride off of a tropical island. In another story, there's a woman who visits art museums alone, and then she meets a man who does the same thing. There's another story about two men in a space capsule orbiting Earth during World War III. You can't imagine being more isolated than that. Characters like this appear in your earlier stories and also in your more recent ones. What is it about solitude or loneliness that you find appealing as a subject?
Well, it's a subject in part because a writer spends so much of his or her time alone in a room. But beyond that, I think it's so suitable for the short story form. And so one or two characters are usually quite sufficient for the demands of a particular idea that will find itself in abbreviated form.
When you look at a book like Underworld, a huge book, sweeping book, and of course you look at these 9 stories, I wonder about the difference in the challenges. I mean, writing a huge book versus writing a small sort of flash, a moment in time. Is one more difficult than the other, or are they just different kinds of challenges?
There are different kinds of challenges in a very important way. Once I knew that Underworld was going to take so long to write, it took 5 years, I truly thought that I would have to live long enough to finish it. And, of course, this doesn't happen when one writes a short piece of fiction. And the other difference is, a novel, as it takes place in my mind, always begins to develop a structure. I begin to feel it happening in the relatively early stages. I have it in my mind that this novel will obey a certain symmetry, perhaps. With a short piece of fiction, this rarely happens. It's one episode, usually, one or two characters. And I think the idea in most cases is to get to the end as quickly as possible.
Do you always write an outline before you actually start?
I don't do an outline at all. I've never done outlines. Whatever I know, maybe in notes, pieces of paper that I scribble on in a subway car or anywhere else, the sense of an outline is all mental.
How do you take those scribbles that you describe from the notebooks and transfer that to the novel?
Well, that's a good question, because there are times when I will look at a note I made 2 or 3 days earlier and wonder what the hell I was thinking of. But most of the time, what I do is just write them down in a larger notebook, which sits at the edge of my desk. And then at certain points, I go through those phrases and those lines of dialogue and figure out that they either do or do not belong in whatever it is I'm writing at the moment. There was a day when I was walking home from a grocery with a shopping bag and got an idea and wrote it. I had no notepad, so I wrote it on the shopping bag, took it home, and used it. Whatever that phrase was, it's somewhere in Underworld.
When you hear people talk about great American writers, inevitably the names Philip Roth and Don DeLillo, Thomas Pynchon are mentioned. It must be gratifying, but is it also strange sometimes?
Well, it's strange in the sense that it's something I certainly never envisioned when I was starting or even much later. And what I think about American fiction is that the best fiction, in my view, is the fiction that takes into account the enormous vitality and the enormous challenge of American life. In other words, I'm talking essentially about big books, although, of course, not exclusively. But the writers I admire, from Sinclair Lewis and up to Norman Mailer, were not afraid to take on that challenge. It seemed to me, when I was working very, very slowly and fallibly on my first novel, that this is what I had in the back of my mind, the challenge of this culture. It's probably why I titled the novel Americana.
You said in an interview, actually, with NPR almost 2 years ago that you felt like you were still 22 in your own mind. So I guess that would make you, what, 23 now?
Very good, yes. It's hard to explain quite what I meant by that, except that most of the time, just walking around, eating a meal, sitting at the desk to do some work, I'm no different. And these are fairly important activities. Of course, I'm aware of the actual chronology in which I'm embedded, but it's not usually a particular source of concern or annoyance. Most of the time, I could be 22 and 23 at the most.
That's Don DeLillo. His new collection of short stories is called The Angel Esmeralda. And this month, he turns 75. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today we're going to talk about a proposal to make your cell phone fair game for robocalls. As federal law stands now, automatic dialers are prohibited from calling wireless phones, that is, unless you give your consent. But a bill before Congress would change that, and joining us to talk about it is Randall Strauss. He's written about the bill in his digital domain column for the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
And Randall, what type of calls would be allowed under this proposed legislation that we're talking about? Would telemarketers, for example, be allowed?
Telemarketing calls would remain forbidden, but it would define permissible calls as anything that isn't a telemarketing call. So if a business were to call you for any reason other than making a direct pitch, it would now be permitted as long as you had, at some point, given your cell phone number to the business.
It sounds from reading your column, Randall, that you think this proposed law is a bad idea. You do not think that robocalls should be allowed to go through to cell phones, right?
That's true. I am concerned that this bill would make it possible for someone to hand over their phone number without realizing that in doing so, they're going to receive calls that they might not want to receive in the future.
And the argument in favor of this, of allowing robocalls to reach cell phones, is what? And it's coming from whom?
There is a group of trade groups led by the financial services industry, groups such as the American Bankers Association and the Mortgage Bankers Association and the trade group that represents collections agencies, that would like to clarify that the very act of giving a business your phone number, your cell phone number, constitutes consent for not just the immediate purpose, but for future purposes.
So in other words, if you use your number for any sort of transaction under the proposed law, that would mean any business that has that number in the future could keep using it, could keep calling you.
Correct. They say all calls that are not a telemarketing call are what they describe as an informational call, which sounds very innocuous, doesn't it?
Sounds innocuous, but consumer groups are really concerned about it. They call the change a wolf in sheep's clothing. What's their argument about that?
Well, all sorts of things could fall under informational calls. So they range from the welcome kind of call, your pharmacy calling you to say your prescription's ready. But there are also other kinds of calls that are not telemarketing calls that might not be so welcome. So collections agencies, for example, would be able to call and leave a message saying you owe a lot of money, and they can make those calls presumably every day.
You know, it's interesting because the cell phone industry says that the law, which goes back 20 years, is really out of date with the way we use cell phones now, that things have changed. We pay for our cell phone service in different ways, so incoming calls don't pose the same financial burden that they did before. Do they have a point with that?
I think this would be a stronger argument if it had been made a few years ago compared to now. But what we're seeing is more and more people are not using their phones to speak with. And the cell phone isn't really just like a landline phone without a tether. It's a much more personal phone. It goes with us wherever we are. So a call that comes in is going to interrupt us literally wherever we are. And that isn't the case with the landline phone that sits on the kitchen counter.
I've been talking with Randall Strauss, who writes the Digital Domain column for the New York Times. He's also a professor of business at San Jose State University. Mr. Strauss, thanks very much.
Thank you.